Good afternoon and welcome to Theatre Boys. In 1982, there was a survey done by Women in Entertainment, and they looked at all the plays that were produced in major repertory companies around the country. And of all the hundreds of plays that went on that year, 26 were written by women, and 24 of those 26 were written by Agatha Christie. Things were not great for women dramatists. But fortunately, something that happened in 1982 was that Carol Churchill wrote Top Girls, which was by no means her first play, but I think it probably was the play that really catapulted her up into the top of the A-list, pretty much. And we're very lucky this afternoon because we have Deborah Findlay on my right here, who was in that production. And with her on the panel, we have a bevy of clamouring lovelies who have been involved in, we've just about worked out, almost every major Churchill play from Light Shining in Buckinghamshire in 1976, which was done by Joint Stock Theatre Company, directed by Max Stafford Clark, whose administrator was Mr. Graham Cowley, who's on my left. And Graham has been involved with Joint Stock, then the Royal Court, and then Out of Joint, which is Joint Stock Revisited, pretty much solidly throughout that time. So all of those plays that Carol did, either for Joint Stock, Out of Joint, or the Royal Court, Graham has been pretty much involved with one way or another. Then we have here Linda Bassett, who was first in Fenn?
Yep.
Then Serious Money, then Far Away, mm-hmm. Plus other things like Plants and Ghosts, the piece that Carol provided a text for the Siobhan Davis Dance Company. So all sorts of things. And Rick has lit about five, I think. Serious Money, This Is a Chair.
No, I didn't do This Is a Chair. Serious Money, Mouthful of Birds, which she co-wrote with David Land, A Number, Far Away, and I think there's one other, but I'm not sure. Well, it might come to us.
It'll come to us as we talk. So whilst some of the debates in the Theatre Voice reputation season will be very much taken up with the kind of the critical overview of the plays, this is not what this panel is about. There are critics and academics up and down the land writing about the cultural significance, the political significance, the dramatic significance of Carol Churchill's work. We're here to discuss what it was like then. Context is all, as every good Marxist literary critic will tell you, and the context here is that these people were there creating the work. They know what it was like, what happened, what got lost, what got written out, how the plays came into being. Can I start, however, with what was the first, what individually were your first connections with Carol's work? If I start with you, Graham. When did you first meet Carol?
During the workshop of Light Shining in Buckinghamshire. Yes, 1976.
And at that point, what was Carol's reputation at that point?
Well, I'd never heard of her. Absolutely not. In fact, the... May I take a minute over this? Because... Joint Stock had been going for a couple of years by then and had done three proper productions, The Speakers, Fan Shen by David Hare, and Yesterday's News, which was a sort of verbatim piece about the massacre of British mercenaries in Angola. And during the course of that play, the writer had dropped out. They sort of lost the writer along the way. So the play was eventually put together out of news testimony and interviews by the actors and the directors. So the next project, Max armed himself with two writers in order to cover his back, and one of them was Carol Churchill, and the other was Colin Bennett, who had written a play for an early Joint Stock play. Colin Bennett dropped out, but it's a measure of how junior Carol was at the time was that she could be mixed with any other junior writer, you know, and not mind.
And Linda, what was your first connection?
First connection was Fenn. I remember writing an application letter to Joint Stock and to the Royal Court, and Joint Stock, I think, filed it in the bin.
After my time.
And it was a series of accidents that actually got me to meet Carol and Les Waters, who directed it, and I went and did the workshop. We stayed for a week in the Fens kitchen.
Because that was very much the Joint Stock method for anybody that's unaware of their rehearsal process. Many of Churchill's plays, and indeed many of the other writers that have worked for Joint Stock and then subsequently for Out of Joint, the plays have been developed through extensive preparatory periods, workshops, research sessions, where actors, directors and writers have kind of pooled their work through improvisation, through exercise, through development, and then Carol has gone away and written plays that sometimes have direct relationship to the workshop and sometimes are more tangential.
Yeah, every writer, I think, has a very different relationship to the workshop. When you were saying about creating the work, I think anyone who's done a workshop with Carol is very aware that she is creating the work. You know, that you're producing interesting material, but the creative process is going on inside her.
Rick, your first connection?
Well, I saw Fenn when I was in New York with an arts festival called New York Salutes Britain or something. Salutes New York. And I went over with a little fringe company called Hesitate and Demonstrate, and we were in one little tiny bit of the public theater, and Fenn was being performed in the other bit of the theater, and so I met Carol then and met the Fenn company, and somehow through some bizarre connection, when Joint Stock commissioned Carol and David Land to write this piece through a workshop called A Mouthful of Birds, I was asked to do the lighting design for it. So that was and through that I remember asking Carol while we were hanging around in the bar one day, and what's your next play going to be about? She said, well, I'm thinking about doing something about the financial markets. And I said, well, that's really interesting, because I think it's, you know, nobody writes about the what generates money, which of course eventually became Serious Money, and I was delighted to be offered the chance to work on that. And then more recently, I've been reconnected with Carol through my lighting design relationship with Stephen Daldry, and we did Far Away and A Number, which are two of her slightly more elliptical, pared-down pieces.
Deborah?
I was just trying to think. I think I saw, because Linda and I saw A Light Shining in Buckinghamshire a long time ago when it was done in York Art Centre, which is a sort of a church, a converted church, which was absolutely extraordinary, and I can remember everybody being completely overwhelmed by it. And then I think I saw Cloud Nine, the original, and three more Sleepless Nights, and that was the first one where I think she'd used overlapping, and that was extraordinary to watch, because that was like the first time anybody had actually done that, and that's so much done now all the time, it's you don't realize how innovative it was. And then I was sent the script of Top Girls, and I can remember being very, very excited by it, not quite knowing what it was all about or what, you know, what all the ramifications were, but just knowing that I wanted very, very much to be part of it.
We'll come back to Top Girls because it's such an iconic piece. Mm. Let's talk a little about Light Shining. Certainly the later plays and plays by other people that have followed Churchill have very much picked up on ideas that Light Shining and Cloud Nine really seemed to inaugurate, i.e. men playing women as a matter of course, colourblind casting, or very specific, this black character must be played by a white actor so that you can see the difference. And Light Shining had the same character played by lots of different actors at lots of different points. Can you remember how that was received at the time, Graham?
With bafflement, I think. In fact, I've just looked up Michael Billington's review, in which he greeted it as a kind of successor to Fan Shen. This is just the sort of thing you'd expect Joint Stock to be doing, you know, political stuff. Without really, he saw that innovative use of the structure whereby actors would swap parts, and what you were then following was the path of the story through these different angles, simply as confusion.
And was clearly for actors watching that at York
very
less
exciting.
Confusing.
I was baffled. I remember, but I was baffled by that, but also excited. You can be both. and I certainly, now when if mates are coming to see one of Carol's plays, I sort of give them a tip and say, don't try and follow it with your head, because you might just fall over. But if you just let it in, just open up and let it in like a poem, let it into you, you'll get the lot. And it's very emotive. And because she's so clever, it appears to be an intellectual exercise, and of course she puts a lot of intellect into it, but they're very much heart pieces, I think. And that's the secret of how to watch them.
I think the analogy to poetry is really more and more appropriate, especially to the later work, I've found. And the way I feel baffled often when I read a poem the first time and don't think, oh, what is this?
Yes.
And then slowly but surely, I know particularly with Far Away, when I first read it, I was almost angry because I felt so excluded from it, and eventually decided that it was actually written completely about my life.
Yes. Unlike Agatha Christie, who you mentioned earlier, yes. where it is all about you, following with your head.
Yeah. But the response to Top Girls, as I recall originally, I mean, I know, Deborah, you don't read reviews. Do you read them afterwards?
No.
I think
it wasn't, because we did it twice. I was in the revival 10 years later. And the first time it wasn't received that well, was it?
No.
And then the second time it was...
No,
was.
I mean, it's since received many backhanded compliments, often in The Guardian, but in other papers too. It's somebody described it as the best play ever written by a woman dramatist. Gee, thanks. It has slowly revealed this. I just remember critics at the time saying things like, well, I mean, it is very good, but I'm not sure it's really a play because it has a three-act structure, because it has a first act where characters from history all meet up and have dinner, and then the second act appears not to be connected with that, with several small scenes set in an employment agency, and then the third act is set in the Fen Country, and there are running characters and running ideas, but it doesn't seem to cohere in a traditional, this is the beginning of a story, this is the middle, and this is the end. And I think that maybe audiences have grown with the work over the years, and people are much more open to the kind of formal experiment that she does. She's kind of educated audiences. When Blue Heart happened, which I actually think is possibly a play, you worked on Blue Heart. No one else has got a Blue Heart connection. But I remember Blue Heart opening at the Edinburgh Festival, and actually that's probably the most, at that point, was the most experimental piece she had written, certainly the first act. And it got almost universally good reviews. I mean, slightly to my astonishment, because I thought, oh, there'll be a lot of very literal-minded critics that can't take this.
Yeah, but it's funny. That's the thing. There's a lot of really funny scenes in that. The first of the two plays is the funnier, too, so you get into a really good mood by the interval.
as a long-term administrator of the work, or producer of the work, do you find that audiences have learned how to read her plays, and that they're easier these days?
Well, of course, her reputation is now, enormous, and that's partly part of the story. The fact that people come expecting a certain kind of iconoclasm and new thoughts when they see a Carol Churchill play, which at the beginning, of course, was just a surprise. and was unexpected. I must say, I mean, I often have a bit of a slow burn on Carol's plays. I mean, not so much with Light Shining, but when we first did Cloud Nine, I was completely in love with the first act, and I didn't know what to make of the second act. I was really quite bored. And as the play continued and I saw it more and more, I got it. And the same thing happened with Top Girls, the same thing happened with Blue Heart with me, actually.
Hmm. Certainly, I know when we did Far Away in New York, where she has a very strong reputation, but it's much more a reputation among academic circles as opposed to the subscription audience of the particular theatre where we were performing it, which was a very small studio theatre. So it was sold out well before they almost even knew what the play was. And the audiences were pretty baffled there, and that's her most recent but one play. So I don't think that bafflement has changed. But then again, as you say, people do connect it, and if they stick with it and just let it sit with them for a day or two, sometimes they all of a sudden the light pops in your head and you think all of a sudden you find your way into the work.
Yeah, having said it, they're not as an intellectual experience. I remember because I was at the first preview of A Number, and I could practically feel the synapses buzzing in my head as new connections. When I didn't exactly know what was, you know, I mean, I was fizzing with it. So, and that's fantastic to go to a theatre and have that happen.
And I do think it's terribly rare the way that Churchill matches and marries form and the content. So it doesn't become, well, there's a technical thing going on somewhere or an intellectual thing going on somewhere, and then there's the plot of the play. She actually makes the two indivisible. The form is what's being talked about and vice versa. But before we stray off into that sort of analysis, let's get back to some nitty gritty. Where shall we start? I'm minded that Deborah Finney has to go and perform on stage tonight, so we don't want to. She may have to leave early. So let's go out of chronological order and look at Top Girls. I've brought with me
my script.
Covered in priceless bits of information.
Well, it's just so funny, and also I don't know where these came from. I just two pages of diary from Monday, 19th of July 1982. Called at 10:30 at Sloane Square for a read through. Met Lindsay Duncan on the steps going in. The set for Insignificance, marble tiles. Selena in a turquoise Lancôme outfit from Fiorucci. Bath buns and coffee. And then we chatted and the read-through. Felt very special to be doing this. Carol spoke about the play, said she'd started out with the idea of extraordinary women, then what choices and sacrifices to be that, on whose terms, mimicking men in a men's world, defining the problem ultimately in a broader political spectrum than merely women overcoming their oppression. Max talked of choices. And then we played status games and all sorts of things. And so that was that. It was extraordinarily hard. I remember particularly the first scene, the dinner scene. I don't know if you've seen it, but that's all sort of overlapping dialogue, people telling their stories. And it was extraordinarily difficult to do the overlapping and to make sense of it, because we'd never done it before. It was very new, and so that was very difficult. And also, I can remember we didn't quite know how the first scene connected with the rest of the play. As Linda says, it's all very sort of tangential, and I don't know how these things connect in her plays. And we kept changing our minds about whether it was a positive celebration of women's achievements or a sort of a depressing view of women's inability to to make it, because they all go through sort of quite agonizing things. And in a way, I think probably what we came up with was it was a bit of both, and it's you get highs and you get sort of deep depressions in the scene, and I can remember, and of course Max directing it, he was very clever and clear that he didn't just want it couldn't just be people telling their stories. It had to be a group of people making relationships. So that's we spent a lot of time in rehearsal, sort of working out who was allying, who was making alliances with whom, who became friends, and who you didn't like, and how that changed, and all of that to make it alive and live, you know.
This was a play that was written for the court. Do you know how much the script that you have there differed from the final production? Was this developed? Was it rewritten much, do you recall?
Well, what, before this? This was the original script, and there's quite... quite a lot of chunks were, as particularly in the first scene, cut. And also, I think that originally there weren't overlappings.
Right.
But it's just that you couldn't actually just have all these women telling their stories. That would have been boring. So it's that she sort of
intercut them
to make it more interesting, really.
The things coming and going reminds me of the business on Serious Money, which you were talking to me about earlier, Rick, about there being a whole set of songs that nobody actually now knows about.
Well, I remember very clearly reading the script for Serious Money, which had lyrics written by Carol in it that were related to the excitement and the thrillingness of greed and money and how exciting it was. And there were probably, I'd say, about 8 songs, do you think, perhaps? Mm-hmm. And then there was one song that was always written by Ian Dury, and the rest were written by Colin Sell, who was the musical director of the production. And they were staged, and we got to about the last week rehearsal, and it was only Ian Dury's song that made it through the final cut. It just felt like they were from another show. And the language of them, but they were quite extraordinary. You know, you sort of loved them and hated them at the same time, these songs, but they...
A lot of them were about third world exploitation. And because we were playing, because everybody in the play, I mean, it's one of the things some people didn't like about the play, was that everybody in the play was heartless and cynical. And some people felt that the songs had been an attempt to balance that, and there was some heart and bit in the songs, but they didn't, for that reason, probably, they didn't quite fit.
They really.
But I remember us all sitting round with Fred and Alina saying, "Max, they don't work." And we all sat there very, you know, with our hearts thumping and.
Yeah.
Didn't you get lots of people from the city coming to see Serious Money?
It was massive. Oh. Yes,
it was sort of suddenly sexy to be in the city, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah, it was. It really conveyed the excitement, the kind of buzz, and they loved to see themselves as pirates.
Yeah,
you know, those guys and women. And a couple of performances were completely sold out to banks, who would bring clients and entertain and watch themselves being penalised.
And they saw absolutely no criticism of themselves. It was all about, they knew people who were like that, but there was no way that was them on stage.
And everybody in it was an absolute villain. Complete crook. But it was all so excitingly done. I mean, that was when I joined the Royal Court, and I went to see it on my first day. And I was just buzzing with excitement about it. It was wonderful.
The people on the Futures floor who, you know, this whole thing about how they were burned out by 40, you know, that you couldn't sort of sustain that life. and you'd meet people who looked, you know, 60 and then they were only 35 and all that sort of thing. But when we did it, we must have sort of got to that pitch, because I remember when we got back together to do that benefit for Max when he left and you set up Out of Joint, and we met again and we had to do one of the songs. And we thought, oh, I can't remember. I can't get. We were so. It was so. The level of adrenaline was so high that you had to get to. You couldn't sing the song unless you were at that level. But it was so high, much higher than anything you ever did. It was, and so fast.
Yeah.
Very.
Do you think that play will ever be? And that play, Signally, has not been given a major revival. There was a season of plays of Carol's at the Sheffield Crucible recently, which didn't do it. It's very much of its time. Do you think it'll come back?
It was, you know, while we were rehearsing it, things were happening. You know, Black Monday happened while we were putting it on stage. So, you know, but she always does this, you know.
Mm.
She always,
and also, I think, Walt, the movie Wall Street came out about the same time, or maybe a year later, and it was very much, you almost felt that they had plagiarized Carol's work, because it was so similar with the cast of villains that were created and put on the screen of Wall Street. But it does get done. It does. Colleges and universities still do it. Every once in a while, I happen to, through my theater magazines, hear about someone doing it again. And it, of course, it's got a huge cast of characters. Everybody played 7 or 8 characters at least. And so for college performances, often they get different people to play those parts because it gives all the students a chance to act in them.
But even in the show, there were, in fact, 16 people. There was the senior eight and the junior eight.
The junior eight, that's right, to fill out the trading
scenes.
One
of whom was Sophie O'Connaden.
Oh.
And one of whom in America was Julianne Moore.
Yeah, well, and Alec Baldwin played the lead guy. I mean, I'll tell one story about Serious Money.
The junior eight.
When we did it in New York, we then transferred it very briefly to Broadway, because basically a play where 16 people walk down to the edge of the stage and at the end of Act One scream cunt at the audience is not going to run. But anyway, it was put on stage, but they weren't allowed to use most of the British actors. And the brilliance of Linda Bassett's performance was that she made the leading woman who took the part think that her part was the best part in the play, which actually I never thought it was, really, for a woman. But Linda did it so brilliantly that the star had to take Linda's part because she thought that's what the part was. One of my parts.
Well, there were five.
I presume it was the Mary Lou Baines.
I think Mary Lou Baines thought she was the star as well.
Yes, I think she certainly convinced, I can't remember the, Kate, who took it? I can't remember now, it's just gone to my head. But anyway, so that was very good.
And that was also the play that there was a row because British Telecom were going to sponsor it and then the sponsorship department said something along the lines of, this is not a play that any serious-minded organisation would wish to be sullied with.
Really?
I remember because we were banging the phones like mad, and then people saying, no, they're only on loan.
We had a lot of technology, you know, and computers on stage and stuff like that.
The green screen.
And that was a play, you know, because people always, you assume that any play you do, you're going to understand what you're saying. I have to say that it wasn't just me, quite a few of us. There were quite a few lines in that play that we didn't know till the end what we were talking about. We said them loudly and clearly, and we didn't bump into the phone. Because you thought you understood it. You thought you understood it, and then you would
try and explain it to someone.
Yeah, and then you'd realise that you... So I'm not going to try and explain it now.
No, don't worry.